This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
Crossover podcast, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck. What up, Beck?
What's happening, my friend?
Well, not a lot in New York right now, because I'm glad we got the Knicks conversation out of the way last week before they got clubbed in the last three games. Double-digit losses, most recently Monday to the Charlotte Hornets. I tell you what, I still wrote about the Knicks this week because I think they're doing the right things, you know, with this franchise. I think they're trending in a positive direction, but not a great week for your hometown Knickerbockers there, Beck.
I don't think the Knicks fans would actually agree with the assessment that they would be my Knickerbockers. I'm not, by the way, I want to just be clear. I'm not claiming the Nets or the Knicks, though I do live about a mile and a half from Barclays Center. Listen, you know me, Chris. I was cringing the whole time last week. I was like, no, it's too soon. You can't start saying like the Knicks are back at 5-3. Like it's, you know, you see this team year in, year out for long enough. There's always a little glimmer of hope, and then the Knicks managed to mess up all the good feelings and three-game losing streak as we speak. But look, I'm one who would think like I wasn't going to overly buy in at 5-3, and I'm not about to kill them at three losses in a row. The progress is there. They're starting to look more like an organized, functioning team, even in the losses. The Tibbs imprint is clear. I don't know how sustainable it all is, but they've got some decent young talent. You got to develop that talent, get on the right path, become respectable. It doesn't matter if they make the playoffs. I don't even care if they make the play-in tournament. For the Knicks' sake, the most important thing is some combination of stability and progress. That's it. Be stable, be respectable as a team. Show some progress that signals to the league that you're on the right path, and free agents might start choosing you again. And that's it. It's really basic. It's really modest expectations, and that's not an insult. That's like you when you've been where you've been for however many years running, that's the steps back to respectability, is just have some stability, have the right people in place, and invest all the minutes that you possibly can in these young players to see what you really have. And look, we've seen glimpses. Even Kevin Knox, who I think a lot of the league had kind of written off, has shown some signs early in this season that maybe he's coming around. So we'll see where it goes from here. But, you know, I'm sure there are a lot of Knicks fans who would like to be able to just like frame the 5-3 and keep it as a keepsake for a long time. Just hold on. Just remember those feelings of that moment, because it might be a while before they can really celebrate at that level again.
Yeah, the start of the season was a mirage. There's no question about it. They won games by playing harder, I think, than everybody else. But even inside the Knicks organization, they knew they weren't going to make a run at the division title or a top five seed in the Eastern Conference. Maybe you could sneak into the play-in tournament, given how many teams could be involved. But that's the ceiling, and that's fine. Like, they're not good, but they're not good with bad contracts. They're not good, but they're not good and dysfunctional. They've got a whole bunch of young guys that they can spend the entire season auditioning. You can see if Kevin Knox, to your point, is somebody that can be part of the rotation of a winning team. You can see if RJ Barrett is ever going to be a reliable shooter. He can score, hasn't shown quite yet he can shoot. You can see if any of these young point guards are worth keeping in the offseason. You can even find out if Mitchell Robinson is going to be worth the big contract he's probably going to command next summer. So it's all fine. Like, even if they go on a 5-6-7 game losing streak, even if they finish, you know, 10 or worst in the Western or the Eastern Conference, you know, it doesn't matter. They're, for the first time in like a generation, they look like a normal franchise. So if you're the Knicks, great. You build on that. As you said, see if you can get free agents to get interested once again, and you take it from there. So I'm not overly concerned about the Knicks. I'm sure their fans are a little bit disappointed right now, but whatever. At least you have some positivity going your way. All right, on this episode, we're going to get into the NBA's COVID response, which, you know, has been getting more severe every single game. We're going to talk about Kyrie Irving, what's going on with him in Brooklyn, the Washington Wizards. Is it time for the Wizards to explore a trade for Bradley Beal, maybe a couple other things as well. But Howard, I want to begin with the COVID-19 issue in the NBA. We saw over the weekend a rash of games postponed. The Celtics, they had their game on Wednesday postponed against the Magic. That could extend into Friday when they have another game against Orlando. The NBA's Board of Governors met on Tuesday. This is after the NBA spoke with their general managers on the call early in the week, and there will be some tighter mandates when it comes to COVID-19 restrictions, whether it's interactions with players on the bench, where players are allowed to go when they're on the road. They're going to try to tighten things up a little bit across the league with some of these rules. It doesn't seem like, though, Howard, that we're headed towards any kind of stoppage, nor does it seem like we're headed towards a bubble of any kind. From what I was told, that didn't come up in the general manager's call. I don't know if it came up at all among the Board of Governors. What did come up in the GM's call was the idea of expanding rosters a little bit, maybe by one extra player that doesn't count against the team's salary cap. That, of course, comes with its own set of potential issues by adding another player into that mix. But what do you think of where we are right now, Howard, with the NBA, with COVID-19, and with the NBA's response to a pretty tough start to January?
I would start here. So let's put the Celtics to the side for a minute, because like the news of the Celtics losing more games having more games postponed hit just as you and I were getting ready to start this podcast. But today, so this is January 12th, we're recording on. This is exactly 3 weeks to the day from opening night of the season. And coming into today, it was three games that have been postponed over 3 weeks. So an average of one a week to this point. Now the number's going to go up because the Celtics just had a whole slate postponed. I don't think, Chris, if you had said to me in mid-December, the NBA is about to start, on average, over the course of this season, they're going to have to postpone one game a week. Or let's say, because the season's broken up into two halves, in this first 36-game stretch, where we are in the midst of the worst time of this entire pandemic, the highest number of cases, highest number of deaths, though the rolling 7-day averages are terrible, the daily averages, everything's bad. It's the worst it's been since this all began. And the NBA starting up amidst this. In the first half of the season, while things are still at their worst and before the vaccines had a chance to really take hold, the NBA is going to have to postpone one game per week. I would say, yeah, that sounds about right. You're starting a season in the midst of the worst pandemic of our lifetimes and in the worst stretch of that pandemic. What else do we expect? There's no bubble. Guys are living at home. They are back to their normal daily routines, curtailed, you would assume, and you would hope. But still, they're at home with their families, with their friends. People are coming and going. The NBA is no more or less susceptible to COVID infections than any other sector of society. And if society is on fire with this virus, why wouldn't the NBA have similar issues? So a game per week on average postponement to me does not strike me as particularly alarming or perilous. This is what the NBA knew it was getting into when they decided to restart. And I'm not saying that they shouldn't have, but there were risks that they knew were assumed in doing it this way with no bubble or mini bubbles or anything else. They're doing the best that they can, I think. But you're dealing with a league of hundreds of people, thousands of people, you know, when you're talking about players and staff. And whatever the multiplier is for the number of possible infections in the course of a day among all those people, this is what's going to happen. No matter how many precautions you take, this is what's going to happen. So I don't think this is particularly alarming, and I don't think it means they need to pause the season or consider canceling the season. I think those are extreme reactions, and I don't think we're there yet.
Well, I don't think there should be any talk of canceling the season. I don't think there should be any talk yet of bringing everybody into a bubble to try to complete the season. I'm on the fence about what a pause would mean for the NBA, because there's three or four teams right now that are just getting waylaid with all this, whether it's the Celtics, you had the Heat before them. I'm not exactly sure what's going on in Dallas. At least four players have tested positive down there, which puts at the very least, their games in peril of not being played. And if they are played, I mean, who's going to be available in a game like that? And how is that game going to play out? Now, a stoppage guarantees nothing, right? You send these guys home, there's a decent chance they come back with the virus as well. I mean, so there's no obvious solution to all this. But given what we've seen from four or five teams in the league, maybe taking a week off isn't the worst idea in the world. And look, the NBA built something like this into the schedule. By only announcing the first half of the season, the NBA has given itself some flexibility to, you know, push this a little bit further. They could even reduce, Howard, the number of games played in the season. Like, you don't need to play 72. Right now, that's the target date. There are reasons for that number, specifically television contracts, but you could drop that down by five or six if it meant, you know, safely completing a season on the timetable you want to complete it on. So I guess I'd leave the door open for the possibility of pausing for a week to 10 days to try to get all this to settle down. I also like the idea of adding as many as two roster spots to the roster. I think that whether it's, you know, in-market guys on, you know, two-way type deals or something like that, I think having, you know, an extra two bodies that are available will make this a lot easier, because at the very least you'll be able to get to that magic number of eight that the NBA requires be available to play some of these games. Right now, as we record this, Howard, I don't know when Boston's going to be ready to play. Like, yeah. You know, I mean, like, you know, they've got a lot of guys either dealing with COVID or in the health and safety protocols that the NBA mandates going to keep them out for several more days. So I think having at least, you know, one or two extra bodies might be a small adjustment that you can make. And that's what I've been hearing from people within the league office, that you're not going to see anything radical happen when it comes to how they're going to deal with this growing number of infections and people being exposed to infections. But they will nibble around the fringes a little bit, and adding bodies might be one way to do it.
You know, look, adding bodies maybe avoids further postponements, right? Or avoids as many postponements, because the postponements are all about they just don't have enough bodies. They don't have the minimum eight players available. But if you fell below eight and you needed a couple of extra bodies just to play, that means you're adding in two-way guys, G-leaguers, whatever, somebody off the scrap heap of available players who maybe they've been with your team for a couple weeks. Maybe you just picked them up yesterday because you didn't know you needed them until now. Like, they're break glass in case of emergency type players. How prepared are they to play a major role in an NBA game on short notice and with your team and without having any time to maybe practice or study your playbook or whatever? Like, that's like it avoids the postponement, but at what cost? You know, what's the impact to the quality of basketball and to your win loss? You might prefer having that game postponed and playing with your full complement of regular rotation guys 3 weeks from now to playing it now with eight guys, two of whom just joined your team yesterday. So I get it. It avoids postponements, but I don't know that it's a great overall solution. And in terms of a pause, like a 1 week, they're going to come back and the country's still going to be on fire. Nothing is changing for our society in terms of the pandemic until enough people have been vaccinated or until enough people wear their freaking masks consistently and stop going out to restaurants and bars. Like, you know, like this is we saw what we could do if we were all really committed to it several months ago. And like, even, you know, here in New York where I am, where we had the infection rate was below 1%, and now it's, you know, up toward, you know, 9 or 10%, I think. Like, there was a time when people were disciplined enough to make having a basketball game, for instance, an NBA game, plausible because broader society wasn't on fire. It is now, and a pause is not going to change that.
Yeah, and well, what do you think then of the NBA's kind of mindset that, you know, let's get through January, things will get better in February? I'm really not convinced of that at this point, Howard. I mean, look, we're in mid-January right now. There's some vaccine distribution going on, but people aren't getting it enough. And even if things change significantly when a new administration is sworn in on January 20th. You're still not going to snap your fingers and have, you know, 200 million people vaccinated within the next couple of months. It's not going to happen. So, I mean, like the NBA, I think they're, you know, their attitude is that things are going to get better. I'm just not sure you're going to see it get better anytime soon. I think it'll be months before we see any kind of effect of a vaccine.
It's going to be months, and it just underscores one other thing too, which we don't talk about that much. There are still five teams. I'm looking at Stein's tweet from last night. There are still five teams allowing reduced crowds right now of various sizes: Cleveland, Houston, New Orleans, Orlando, and Utah. Like, what are we even doing right now? You know, the Raptors playing in Tampa, they stopped admitting fans, for the time being. The Hawks have pushed back when they're going to do it. Why are any teams at a time that the league is considering all these things that we're discussing and games are being postponed, why are any fans in the building at all, even spaced apart? They're not wearing masks consistently. It's like the extremes that the league is going to with its own teams to try to manage the virus and to maintain some semblance of safety. To then have any fans in the building at all just strikes me as kind of ludicrous, given what the numbers are across the country, including some of the cities I just named that are allowing fans. So I get it. Like, you want to have some still connection ongoing with your fan base. I can't imagine the money that they're making from the handful of fans they're letting in, a couple hundred, a couple thousand, is making that big of a difference at a time when you're losing, you know, tens of millions. But why are we doing this at all, Chris? Like, that to me needs to come up somewhere in the course of these conversations. Why are any of your teams admitting fans at all, given where this country is right now with the virus?
No, and it's not making the pandemic any better. Look, they have mandates that people wear masks, but as we know, it's not always done in these venues. So
you can see it when the cameras are. You can see it when the cameras are scanning the arenas, Chris. Especially if you're watching on League Pass and you don't always have the straight commercial, where instead you just get the in arena camera where it's moving around, catching fans, eating, doing whatever. And yeah, there's masks off all the time.
Yeah, I guess the bottom line is we're not going to see the NBA make any type of dramatic shift off their current plan. At least not that we want it to be this way. But if it becomes a situation where half the teams in the league are dealing with this type of problem, then maybe the NBA, I think, will make some changes. But until then, Howard, I think look, it's been written and we've said it, but they're going to push forward. They're just going to push on with this strategy moving on. So that's where we are. All right, let's talk a little bit about Kyrie Irving and the Nets. Irving is going to miss his fourth straight game this week. For personal reasons, he has not been around the team for the last four games. ESPN reported the expectation is that Kyrie won't be with the team for the rest of the week. Meanwhile, on social media, a video has surfaced of Kyrie that appears to be him at his sister's 30th birthday party, which the NBA is now investigating as we record this. So, Howard, your reaction to what we know about Kyrie Irving. Now, I hesitate to attribute reasons to why he's been away from the team. There's been some reporting on Kyrie being upset about what he saw on video at the Capitol last week. Kyrie, of course, has been very invested in these types of issues. It was Kyrie who, after the death of George Floyd, the killing of George Floyd, was one of the strongest voices towards NBA players about not going to the bubble, but taking a stand on these social issues. So, you know, that reporting lines up with what we know about Kyrie. But Howard, at some point, Kyrie's going to have to come back to play. And that video, if it's authentic and happened this week, if Kyrie without a mask at a birthday party for his sister, it's not a good look for Kyrie Irving.
No. And look, I want to start with this premise, Chris. We don't know for certain why Kyrie is away from the Nets right now. We don't. I know there's been some reporting, and I'm not pouring cold water on any of that reporting. I'm just saying that there is no clear objective truth right now, and certainly not from Kyrie himself or his agency or his spokesperson or anybody. We don't know. And so because these are really unusual circumstances on many levels, and because we have not yet heard it from him or anybody on his behalf, I'm going to be very cautious about judging what he's doing and what the purported reasons are. Because what happens is, if you take it at face value that, oh, it was about news events of last week, the cop being, getting to walk away free in the Jacob Blake shooting, the storming of the Capitol. If these things are weighing on Kyrie, who certainly has a political conscientiousness, and people can think of that whatever they want. But if those are the reasons, then yes, of course, immediately when people see him smiling and celebrating with his family and hanging out at a party, it doesn't look great. But that's making a bunch of assumptions first. It's assuming that he's away for the reasons that you've heard. I don't know, Chris. I don't want to assume that. He's away for personal reasons. That's the only official reason we have been given. I'm going to, for me, withhold judgment on all of it until we know, hopefully from Kyrie himself, what the circumstances were. And just because you were away for personal reasons, whatever it was, mental health break, concern over events in society at large, whatever it may be, does not automatically negate your ability to then celebrate a birthday with your family. Also, when it comes to the COVID protocols, it's not clear yet whether or not he broke those, because we don't know from that short snippet of video whether there were more than 15 people, which is the standard the NBA is using for gatherings that are off limits to their players. So if it was fewer than 15 people, he might be fine. And so it may not trigger anything on that level either. Yes, it's curious that he's been away as long as he has, and that he's not coming back, at least based on the reporting, anytime this week. I don't know what that's about, Chris. I don't like speculating blindly on that stuff. It's certainly a problem for the Nets, who obviously have the highest of expectations this season. Their first season with Kyrie and KD together. They've already lost Spencer Dinwiddie for the season. They've been up and down as a team. Missing Kyrie Irving for any extended stretch for any reason is a concern. But I also think that these unusual circumstances and the lack of clarity about it presents a larger concern, which is he still on board? And that's a natural thing to wonder. Like, what is there something else we're missing here? Is there something else we're missing about Kyrie Irving's satisfaction or happiness with the Nets, this team? I don't know. And again, I'm not speculating that that's the reason. I'm just saying the extended absence without much clarity, at least publicly, I think leads you to have to wonder about, where this season's going for the Nets with Kyrie.
Two things I observed from the last week. One, it was interesting to see Steve Nash's initial reaction to Kyrie's absence. If you remember that first press availability, Nash indicated that he had no idea where Kyrie was. He kind of maybe opened up a little more than the Nets would have liked on that subject. Since then, he has said, I've spoken to Kyrie Irving. I'm keeping those discussions between Kyrie and myself. Other players that have been asked about it have said the exact same thing. But I thought it was interesting that, on the first day of Kyrie's absence, Nash didn't seem to have any idea where his star player was. It's also very clear that the Nets are treating this situation with kid gloves because, to your point, they know the importance of Kyrie Irving to all this, and they can't have this become a thing that snowballs. It's one thing if Kyrie misses 5 games in January. It's another thing if this becomes a lingering issue that infects the locker room, that becomes a fissure between Kyrie and the coach, Kyrie and the front office. Look, teams have won championships with bad chemistry before, but more often than not, they don't. More often than not, you need, great chemistry to win a championship. And I mean, it was only 2 years ago Kyrie was on a team that had great potential and didn't win a championship. So, I mean, those are the two things I feel like I know at this point, that Steve Nash not having any idea where Kyrie was kind of telling on that first day, and, how the Nets are handling this. I have to imagine that there's got to be some degree of frustration within Brooklyn as you're trying to kind of put together a team and develop chemistry right now. But they are clearly going to be very delicate with this situation until it becomes, untenable. I think it was Bobby Marks that tweeted out earlier in the week saying basically like, you know, at some point Kyrie's going to have to come back. At some point he's going to have to play, or the Nets are going to have to, you know, operate like a business and, you know, perhaps begin finding him or some such. So, you know, I think we're still at that point where Brooklyn's going to be very careful in this situation, but we may be barreling towards, you know, a showdown between Kyrie and the Nets. Because, look, you're right, Howard. We don't know how many people were at that party. It's guessing, but it seemed like a party. You know what I mean? Like it was at an event. It was at a, looked like a restaurant or a nightclub of some kind. It just, you know, I'd be surprised if there were under 15 people in that venue. And if there wasn't, you're talking about having to quarantine and go through some of that stuff, which is maybe another week that you're dealing with. These, you know, these days and these games are starting to add up. So
yeah.
I think we're getting to an inflection point. I think we're not there yet, but I think we're getting there.
And to be clear, Chris, there is a scenario here where he's not in violation at the party, and a scenario where his absence is justified and completely fine with the Nets. And there's, you know, a scenario where he comes back and everything is just fine. Yes, there is also a scenario where there were more than 15 people and he's in violation. And at the moment he returns, he's still got to do the quarantine. And maybe they're not that happy with the, just the clash of images here of him being gone, presumably for reasons of whatever it may be, something serious, and yet celebrating with fans. Like all of these things, there's a best case and a worst case scenario on the table, and I don't know where it's going to fall. I'm just not prepared to, jump to conclusions on any of those, on any of that stuff yet. But yes, there's the potential here for this to be a very serious problem for the Nets.
Yeah, for a team that's, you know, has the talent to win a championship this season, resolving this sooner rather than later is obviously for the best. All right, let's talk for a minute about Bradley Beal with the Wizards. Beal is leading the NBA in scoring. He has been great all season long, but the Wizards have not. They're 3-8 as we record this. Russell Westbrook is out for at least the next few games with a quad injury. You got Thomas Bryant, the starting center. He is done for the season with an ACL tear. And you've got a team in Washington that looks like it's barreling towards a lottery appearance. It's still early, only 11 games in for the Wizards, but it's not looking good for Washington. And if you're the Wizards, you've got to start thinking about whether Bradley Beal really wants to be there. He's got 1 year left in his contract after this season. He has not, to be fair, made any kind of public statements about being unhappy in Washington. He has not, you know, through his people, privately leaked out that he wants out of Washington. But if you're the Wizards, kind of got to start looking at this situation objectively and thinking, if Bradley Beal is not 100% committed to being a Wizard for the next 3, 4, 5 years, you've got to think about dealing him, because he is an incredibly marketable commodity. He's one of the best shooters in the NBA. As we've seen this season, he is a proven scorer. He's going to bring back huge value in return if the Wizards decide to deal him. So what do you think of this Beal situation? Is it, in your mind, still developing in Washington? I mean, how close do you think the Wizards should be in making a move?
You know, given how new the Beal-Westbrook partnership is, given how young their group is, you know, a lot of minutes for the rookie Denny Avdia, and, you know, Rui Hachimura is a second-year player, and, you know, and now they've lost Thomas Bryant for the season. Like, you can look at all these things and put a bunch of qualifiers on it and say it's early, get Westbrook back healthy, let Beal and Westbrook have a longer run together before you make any judgments about the viability of this team. Factor in the Thomas Bryant injury. Like, there's a bunch of things, caveats you could put on all this and say the Wizards might still be fine. But since I have been on the record, Chris, for a while here and thinking that Bradley Beal, for all the honorability of his stance of I'm not asking out, I'm not going to make demands, I'm loyal to this franchise, I want to stick it out, I want to turn this around, I have thought for some time and remain convinced that Bradley Beal will be better off somewhere else, that the Wizards will be better off cashing in his value to start over, and that it's inevitable that that's where those parties will end up. I don't know who gets there first. If it's the Wizards going to Beal, probably not. It's probably Beal going to them. But I don't see anything, Chris, in the next 3 to 5 years that indicates what they have is the basis for a breakthrough team, a contending team, a team that can get where Bradley Beal has not been, which is beyond the second round of the playoffs. And on top of that, Bradley Beal's been very open with how disappointed, frustrated, angry that he was last season. And I think justifiably so, that he did not make the All-Star team. He did not make All-NBA. His averages last season, 30 points, 6 assists, and 4 rebounds a game on decent shooting percentages. The efficiency went down a little bit last season because of the load he was carrying. But certainly numbers that justified All-Star selection. Certainly numbers that justified All-NBA. I think I had him on my third team on my ballot, but he didn't make it. He's been to the second round of the playoffs 3 times. His other time in the playoffs, he was out in the first round. So 4 playoff appearances, never outside of the second round. The highest win total they've had in his time there is 49. That was when he and Wall were both at their peak. And he's 27. He's in his prime. He is squarely in his prime. He's one of the best players in the league, certainly one of the best shooting guards in the league. And there are teams that would do backflips if they could get him. And if you don't have any case to make that things are going to turn around soon, and I'm not sure that the Wizards do, then I just don't see it. And I should mention, our colleague Michael Pena, of course, wrote about this subject today on SI.com. In his piece, he notes that the 538 blog has the Wizards at 11% to make the playoffs. 11%. That's not a lot to bank on, and that would mean a third straight year out of the playoffs for Bradley Beal. At a certain point, you got to just come to grips with the reality of the situation, which is that the Wizards do not have a clear path to contention in the next few years, and better for all parties if he moves on to a better team and they get, I would hope, a boatload of stuff back for him.
No, look, it's over. It really is. Yeah. It is. No, it's over. Like, for everything you said, all the reasons you articulated there, it's over. I mean, he's got 1 year left in that contract. He's not going to sign a long-term deal there. I mean, yeah, if I'm wrong, I'll say I'm wrong, but I don't think he's going to sign a long-term deal there. I mean, why would he at this point if you're looking to win at this stage of your career? He's going to be able to get a max contract on the market when he hits it in a couple of years. It's over. And now the question is, what can you get back in return? And if I'm Washington, I'm on the phone like right now with the Golden State Warriors. I just am. Like, if I could pry away James Wiseman, who I think is going to be a really good player, and that pick next year that they have, the lightly protected pick from the Timberwolves, who also stink right now, that's a deal I would make. You got to take back Andrew Wiggins to make the salaries work. Fine, whatever. But if you can get Wiseman, who I think is going to be an all-star level big man for years to come, maybe not for a couple of years, he's only 19 years old, you get Wiseman, you got a big man in place, you get that next pick, you have maybe a top 5, top 6 pick to work with in next June's draft, a draft that is widely projected to be really good. What are we talking about here? Like, your team is bad, and they're bad, and they're young. So you can add players to the mix that fit the timeline. I think Rui Hachimura is going to be a decent player. They might have something there with the kid from Israel. Like, I mean, they've got some decent pieces there, but it's going to take years for those guys to develop. Why not get players that fit that timeline? What's the best case scenario with a healthy Bradley Beal and a healthy Russell Westbrook to the end of the season? Make the playoffs? Get whooped up by what? You know, Milwaukee or Boston or Miami in the first round? Is that worth it? If you can get the Warriors to bite on Wiseman, that pick, and Andrew Wiggins, I'm done. It's over. It's a wrap. Trade Bradley Beal. It was a smart move to start the season with him because, first of all, John Wall kind of screwed you there a little bit because he, you know, announced his trade demand a week before teams reported back to training camp. But you want to see what Beal and Westbrook looks like. Maybe you get off to a hot start. Maybe Beal's like, you know what? Without Wall, it's my team. All that good stuff. But now, here we are. And it's over. You know, it's either over now or it's over 6 months from now. You might as well start really exploring the idea of getting it over now.
And look, the optimistic view, Chris, would be this. Westbrook comes back. They're healthy. They've got one of the most potent backcourts in the league with those two guys. The defense will never be great, but maybe the defense comes around a little bit. Avdija makes a really big leap as a rookie. Hachimura makes a good second year leap. The young guys become contributors right away. And next season, maybe they are middle of the pack playoff team. Maybe if everything breaks right and Thomas Bryant comes back healthy, like their best case scenario. And granted, you know, this, we don't know what happens in the draft or in free agency or the trade market, but their best case scenario. And look, Westbrook's, you know, what, 32. There's not a long window anyway with him and Beal together. and both at an elite level, because Westbrook will start to go into decline in some indications that maybe he already has. That's the normal thing for a guy in the early 30s. That's not a knock on Westbrook. But their best case scenario is still not a really encouraging one, and it would have a very short lifespan. And so, yeah, I believed this a year ago before, more than a year ago before Beal signed the extension and after he signed the extension. All of this was just delaying the inevitable, and the trade will come. The more interesting question is going to eventually be, what can they get for him? Can it be as big of a payout as what the Thunder got for Paul George, or as what the Pelicans got for Anthony Davis? Every situation's different. Every negotiation's different. But look, to your point, the Warriors, you know, the Warriors, despite their kind of, you know, mini resurgence here, they still got a pretty low ceiling for their postseason success this season. If you can get Beal, and then you've got Klay coming back next season, I mean, Wiseman has shown just enough that that's now, like a few weeks ago, it would have been like, yeah, absolutely, positively, no doubt, Wiseman, the Timberwolves pick, your own pick, whatever, and get Beal. And you're back in business immediately and for the future when Klay comes back. But man, I like that. I'm not a big who says no game person, but that's actually become somewhat of a more strained conversation, I think. Like, Wiseman's shown just enough in his short time in the NBA that I think the Warriors, it would be difficult. It'd be difficult to give up a piece that you think could be foundational for the post Steph Curry era.
It's a gamble, no question about it, but I'm more comfortable with that gamble knowing Beal, you know, is 27. It will be 28 at the start of next season. Yeah. He is lined up with the prime years of your star players. If you're talking about giving Steph Curry a massive contract a year and a half from now, Klay still under contract, Draymond under contract, like, are you going to roll the dice and say and hope that Wiseman in year two, year three, year four is going to be the kind of dominant center that will make you a favorite in the Western Conference? Or do you add a proven player like Beal now and give yourself not quite what you had with Curry, Thompson, and Durant, but like the next thing right below it with three guys that can fill it up, and Draymond in that front court? Find yourself, you know, an Andrew Bogut type. Find anybody that can play the pivot. I'm sure they're going to be available across the league and roll and play that way. I just think for both sides, it just makes too much sense. I mean, I agree. You might have some kind of headaches later on when you're watching Wiseman, like 5 years from now, you know, become a star in the NBA, and whoever they get with that potential Raptors pick, or I'm sorry, the Timberwolves pick, that could be problematic as well. But this is what you do. You got to get something, you got to give something. You can't just give nothing away in that situation.
And the bottom line is this. Like, it's really nice if you can pull off the rare feat of being a contender and somewhere along the way during your, you know, the latter stages of your dynasty, while it's starting to disintegrate and guys are getting old, and you can somehow add a piece that's now the foundation for your next contending. That if you can pull that off, great. It's really rare. In fact, it almost never happens. And even the quick turnaround the Celtics made when Danny Ainge traded Pierce and Garnett for all the Nets stuff that included, you know, the picks that became Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum, that's really rare to pull off. So if you believe that Wiseman has that kind of upside, it's one thing. But the real mission, though, is this. The mandate is this. When you have a generational talent like Steph Curry, you get everything out of him that you can and make sure that he is absolutely the best possible position to contend for as long as possible. So it's not about the future. It's not what James Wiseman will be 5 years from now. It's about who you can have around Steph Curry right now to make sure that he can continue to contend while he is still playing at an elite level for as many years as possible. And if that means sacrificing the future, F it. You do it. You do it, because if you got a shot to add another ring or two and extend this dynasty out, that's the ball game. That's what you do. That's what you're there for. So all that said, if he's on the table, if he's on the market, Denver should be all in for him. I think the Pelicans should be all in for him. I don't know if the Nets have what it takes to get it done. I think he's a better fit than, say, Harden would have been. You can make a case for the Raptors. I can make a case for the Hawks. Like, there are a lot of teams that you don't have to necessarily go from like playoff to contention, but maybe even just from fringe playoff to top four type team. Like the Hawks, I don't know, like, there's still a lot of young pieces, but you can make a big leap. if you're adding Bradley Beal to that mix with the guys you got there. So there are plenty of really intriguing packages, I think, that could come together if, you know, they wake up one day and decide that, that Beal is on the market.
Now, that day should be today. Like I'm ready to pull the plug on any hope for Bradley Beal lasting down in Washington. Before we go, Howard, I want to circle back to the COVID-19 discussion we were having at the top of the show. As we're recording this, the NBA is announcing some new protocols. I'm going to read from Adrian Wojnarowski's Twitter feed right now. NBA players can no longer interact with non-team guests at road hotels. Players were allowed to have guests in the room. That is no longer the case. At home, players and team staff must remain at residences except to attend team-related activities at the facility or arena, exercise outside, perform essential activities, or the occurrence of extraordinary circumstances. On the road, players and staff cannot leave their hotels except for team activities or emergencies. No more approved restaurants, which was on the previous list of things you could do. And for a minimum of the next 2 weeks, pregame meetings and locker rooms are limited to 10 minutes with masks on. All other meetings with players and staff must be on the court or a larger space that allows for 6 feet of social distancing. Any person who regularly visits the inside of the home of a team staff member or player for professional purposes must undergo COVID testing twice per week. So this is kind of what we talked about at the top of the show, some sort of nibbling around the fringes with some of these rule changes. No word yet about expanding rosters. We'll see if that happens in the coming weeks. But, I mean, is this enough? Or is this, Howard, all you can do if you're the NBA?
Well, there's one piece you missed, which I think was his first tweet on this, which was also no hugging or interaction of rival players on the court pre- or post-game, and reducing social interactions during games, including tapping hands during free throws. You shouldn't be tapping hands during free throws anyway. You should be concentrating on making your free throws. Tapping hands is just messing with your routine. I just dispense with that altogether, COVID or no COVID. And a lot of people who are like of the old school variety will be happy to hear that there will be less hugging. You know, I'm sure the Michael Jordans and the Charles Barkleys of the world will love less hugging and fraternizing. Listen, those are everything that you just read from the report about what the league and the union have agreed to tamp down on things. It's all reasonable. It's going to be difficult on some level, but it is also the reality that all of us are living right now, at least those of us who are trying to do our best to do our part to stem the spread of COVID. Staying at home, not seeing my friends. When I do see them, it's outdoors and with our masks on and at 6 feet. The players are being asked to do what I think all the rest of us, and again, let's be clear. If all of society were abiding by all this diligently and with conscientiously and consistently, we wouldn't have the numbers that we do in this country with the virus. But it is essentially back to where we all began with this whole thing when we all first started coming to grips with it, which is we have to curtail all of our social activities. We have to stay home more. We have to be really careful. And what the NBA is imposing are, you know, it's going to be tough because players aren't going to want to curtail their social life at home or on the road. Who does? Nobody does. And it can be really lonely, long trips on the road, period. If the only people you can see are your teammates and staff and everything else, I don't want to dismiss it. I don't want to like say like, oh, it's easy. You guys make millions of dollars. Like, no, it's tough. There is a weight on the psyche to dealing with all this stuff, which all of us can relate to because we've all been dealing with it, but it's what's necessary. And if keeping guys away from, you know, any other, you know, whatever, random people, if you could just stem the spread that much more, if your team meetings are being limited so that they're not even with each other as much anymore, well, then there's much less likelihood that you wake up one day and have four of your guys all in quarantine, either for testing positive or contact tracing, because that's the other part of this, Chris. The more time guys spend around each other, a single positive test means now you go contact tracing. How many guys were within close proximity for X amount of time? That's how you end up wiping out half of a roster and having to postpone multiple games. So if you want the season to be able to continue unimpeded with minimal interruptions and minimal postponements, this is what you do. And it sucks, and it's going to be difficult, and I don't know how well they'll be able to enforce it or how effective it'll be, or whether you can get 450 players to all completely buy into everything that we just went through. But it is the right thing. This is the way to try to stem the tide of postponements.
I read this thinking we're inching towards a bubble. I do. Because, look, guys under these new protocols can still go home, sleep in their own beds, be around their families. But the NBA is basically saying you can't do anything else. You are on house arrest at this point. And, I mean, look, it is a big leap to go from, you know, being on house arrest in your home to having kind of the freedom to walk around at a Florida hotel. But, you know, I read this stuff saying if it continues to get worse, this is a step towards a bubble. It's not, you know, you're not quite there yet, but you're moving towards a bubble-like environment. If it continues to spread in the next couple of weeks, I wouldn't be surprised if the NBA starts to really consider some radical ideas. Like, they're not now, but this is some pretty strong strong stuff they're asking players to do to protect against the spread of this this virus. So
yeah, and it just became official, by the way. The league and the union just sent out the press release to announce all of that. So
it's like podcasting in real time. It's nice when you can, you know, kind of like, I'm going to read off a tweet, and now we have the official release. So this time next week, maybe we start recording like late at night, just in case we run into this problem.
Because nothing ever happens at 2 a.m.
No, not at all. Howard, good to talk to you, man. Always appreciate it.
Always a pleasure, my friend.